Hi, I'm Jonathan Burke, Professor of Finance at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University.
And I'm Jules van Binsbergen, a finance professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania.
And this is the All Else Equal podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Today, we are talking about climate disclosures mandated by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yes, Jules. So, as you know, our original idea was to try to ask Gary Gensler, who's chairman of the SEC, to come on the show and talk about it, but he chose not to come. So instead, what we're going to do is try to make Gary Gensler's argument and try to understand that argument. So the argument goes something like this, that the SEC has a role in making sure that investors understand the risks of their investments, and then investors get to decide if they want to take those risks. But obviously, they can't take the risk unless they know they exist. And so Gary Gensler's view is that investors have to understand climate risk, and as a result, the SEC has to mandate disclosure of that risk.
Yeah, and so one of the tasks of the SEC is indeed to protect investors. And so one could indeed argue that being informed about the risks that companies have and knowing and understanding those risks better could facilitate investors making better investment decisions. But I do think, Jonathan, we have a big question here, and that is, well, why climate? What is so special about climate that this deserves a special category? Why doesn't this just fall under general disclosure requirements? Do we have a separate category for this?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I don't really understand. I mean, I understand that climate is an existential risk that firms face, but there are other existential risks that firms face. I mean, some very unlikely, like a media strike, but some, I would say, much more likely than climate. For example, a pandemic risk or, you know, nuclear war risk. I mean, especially pandemic risk after what we just went through. Let's be honest. The COVID pandemic was a relatively mild pandemic. We were talking about death rates of around 1%. There's arguments about that. In the plague, 25% of Europe died. So you have to ask the question, what would happen if we had a pandemic which had a death rate that was in the teens or the 20s? That seems to me a more likely scenario, given what we just went through. And there's no sense that firms have to disclose about their pandemic risk.
No, and so clearly firms themselves could choose to make disclosures about what consequences another pandemic would have for them. And let's be clear, I think that the pandemic had a major influence on many different companies and many different aspects of those companies, whether or not their workforce was able to come to work, the way that the demand for their products was affected, the way management was able to interact with its employees. And despite this large effect of the pandemic, we do not seem to have a special disclosure requirement that specifically targets pandemics and asks companies to publish or to investigate and get data on their exposure to pandemic-related risks. So if we don't have it for pandemics, it seems very interesting why climate has been singled out to have such disclosure requirements.
And leaving that aside, so let's just leave that aside and assume that, okay, we have to focus on climate. The second question I think to ask is, why does the SEC have a role here? Why don't firms voluntarily disclose?
And that's a particularly important question because, you know, whenever you observe disclosure, there's always what we call in economics the risk of adverse selection, right? Which is that certain companies will be more likely to disclose or truthfully disclose than others. And so bad companies will not want to disclose or not want to disclose truthfully. And so we potentially have what's called a lemons problem here. So is that an issue here?
Well, Jules, let's just be very explicit. This is a wonderful all else equal mistake. If you assume, okay, well, the result is good companies will disclose and bad companies won't disclose, and that means you won't find out about bad companies, that's an all else equal mistake because there'll be a reaction. Investors will see that some companies are not disclosing and they will correctly infer those are the bad companies and they will assume that they have a lot of risk. And then the bad companies, there'll be a cross-sectional variation across the bad companies and the bad companies that are better off, the ones that haven't disclosed, will suddenly say, well, we don't want to be pooled with the idea that we're terrible, so they'll disclose. And then that will continue. And in the end, all companies will disclose.
Well, yes, we will certainly see, let's to be precise, we will see behavior indeed consistent with investors not being able to tell the good companies apart from the bad companies, whatever those bad companies need to do to make that pooling happen. right? It's not necessarily the case.
Jules, that's a good point. The bad companies might disclose, but they may lie.
Exactly.
Right? And so that's a very good point. And there, I think there is a role for a regulator. So what does a regulator do? It says, look, we're going to make sure you don't lie. So we set up a system where we say, there are a couple of ways of lying. There's the obvious way of lying, just tell facts that aren't true. But there are more subtle ways of lying. For example, what you could do is disclose an enormous amount of information. Most of it's totally irrelevant and very hard for investors to figure out where the relevant disclosures are. So in order to avoid that, what the SEC has done in other cases is they mandate disclosure in a very standardized way. And then they have audit companies checking that the companies aren't lying.
Well, so first let's take a step back, Jonathan. Honestly, if you are in this situation as a company and you know that the SEC mandates disclosure and you're actually not quite sure what it is that we're all trying to measure, wouldn't that already be an incentive to just disclose then a lot and give a lot of information? So even if your intention was just not to want to break the law, that could already be a reason to disclose more. But maybe indeed, as you said, maybe there's a signal jamming motive too, which is that you just disclose so much information that nobody can tell the relevant parts anymore. But I think there's an even more important point in this for me, which is this. If I want to check that somebody is not lying, do I not first need to have a solid grasp of how things are supposed to be measured and what the correct answer is?
The argument that, look, the SEC has a role in making sure you have accurate disclosure works fine for cash flow statements or for balance sheets. But for climate, I think we have a real problem because it's not even clear what needs to be disclosed. I mean, to take an example, the climate models, the models that model what's going to happen. There are many models that don't agree with each other. How will the SEC decide which model to use? And even if you do decide, okay, fine, we're going to have a formal way of disclosure, how are you going to audit it? I mean, what numbers are you going to look at? The company will say, in the future, we think X. Well, how would an audit company possibly audit a statement like that? So I just don't understand, first of all, how you could standardize the disclosure, and second of all, how you could audit this disclosure.
No, and I do think that whenever we have regulation, enforceability seems like an incredibly important step. If you already know that you can't really effectively enforce, I think it's important to rethink whether the regulation makes sense at that point.
Well, and the other thing, which I know we've discussed, is, does the company really have a comparative advantage in this realm? I mean, obviously, if I'm revealing, look, this is how much I spent on cash registers, or this is what I spent on computers, the company clearly has a competitive advantage that the company knows that information better than anybody else. But here, it's not clear to me the company has a comparative advantage. Does the company really know more about how the climate will affect the company that investors know about how the climate would affect the company?
No. So indeed, let's take some of the other examples that you mentioned at the beginning. Think about a nuclear war. Do you think that companies can assess properly what their exact exposure to a nuclear war would be, given the fact that we haven't seen it, we haven't lived through it? With the pandemic, it may at this point be a little easier because at least companies have experience with what happened to their various business activities, to their customers, to their suppliers, to their employees when the pandemic hit. Although, as you pointed out, this pandemic was one with a very low death rate. If you had one with a very high one, things could be, again, be completely different. So does the company have a comparative advantage to disclose risks that it would have for nuclear wars and or pandemics? And if the conclusion is probably they don't have much of a comparative advantage, then why would they have a comparative advantage for climate risk exposures? It's not quite clear to me.
You know, part of it really worries me about trying to predict how the companies will react, how the economy will react, is it depends critically on regulation and lawmakers, right? I mean, if a pandemic hits again, how the lawmakers will react will be a critical determinant in what happens next. And I don't know why companies would have any better idea of how lawmakers would react than investors or lawmakers themselves for that.
Well, so Jonathan, maybe we can then make a joke. Maybe the SEC should mandate that companies disclose what their risk exposure is to the SEC's regulation. Maybe that's a risk measure that they should be.
Exactly. Not a joke. When I talk to people about this and I say to them, look, how in the world would a company know what is climate exposure is. We have no idea what's going to happen to the climate. They say to me, no, Jonathan, you don't understand. It's not that they worried about the climate. They worried about regulation that's going to be put in place because of the climate. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is the thing. So what the risk is the SEC's future rules? I mean, then I think we really are in bad shape, where the worry is, what will lawmakers do to come?
So Jonathan, I do think indeed that regulatory risk is something that companies, I know, are very worried about because it can materially affect their business activities, their profitability, and therefore their stock valuation and their ability to pay back debt, all of that.
Well, Jules, I think maybe this is time to introduce our guest. I mean, thus far, we've concentrated on the economics of the decision, but there's a whole legal side which we haven't talked about and for which we don't have the expertise to talk about.
Yeah, I think that the guest that we have today is somebody who has a lot of expertise in that area because, you know, he has actually filed a comment letter, right? And I think, Jonathan, you signed this comment letter too, right? Because you thought that this was an important issue for the SEC to pick up.
Yes, Jules. Our original idea was to have a high-level person from the SEC come on the show and explain the logic of the regulation. They declined to come, and maybe for good reason. So we thought that getting Larry Cunningham's view would be obviously not a substitute for that, but I think he'd bring a tremendous amount of knowledge on the legal perspective. So let's just tell our listeners who Larry Cunningham is. He is a Henry St. George Tucker Research Professor of Law Emeritus at George Washington University, and he's also a special counsel for Mayor Brown. The reason we have invited him, though, is the lead author and organizer of what is probably the most influential comment letter, which he submitted to the SEC. And I was one of the co-signers and co-contributors to that comment letter. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Larry, let's start with a fundamental question. Do you think the SEC actually has legal authority to require climate exposure?
It's doubtful. The SEC's congressional grant of authority is to promulgate regulations and enforcement for the protection of investors. And that usually means, when it comes to disclosure of information, requiring disclosure of information that is material to investors. There's a term of art for you that refers to information that reasonable investors would consider important in making an investment decision. One of the major problems with this proposal is that it's not anchored in concepts of materiality. And so it veers away from that investor protection rationale. And so I think it's the proponents of SEC authority and what the supporters at the commission believe is that the investor protection rationale is endlessly elastic. And so any information that SEC believes would be important to investors is within its mandate. And the SEC says, and we've done a lot of research and have expertise and have heard from many investors who say this information is important and necessary. That's the debate. The way I read it, there's enormous quantities of data that are unanchored by the materiality principle. And that bleeds into one more point, Jonathan, if I can make it, is that the topic the SEC is addressing and the way it's addressing it is one of major economic and political significance. And when an agency engages in rulemaking of that sort, it has to be able to point to specific language in its congressional authorization to support it. And there's no such specific language in the Securities Acts. So the SEC will face legal battles on whether it has this authority.
So Larry, what directly motivated you, in addition to these materiality concerns, of course, to organize the highly influential comment letter that you sent in response to this proposal?
Well, I was appalled when I read the proposal because it relies overwhelmingly on environmentalists and prominent climate activists and cites essentially no prominent investors and ignores the protection of individual investors, which is the SEC's mandate. And I respect the SEC as an agency, and it has historically safeguarded investors. And so I felt compelled to act when I read this. And so I reached out to a group of scholars to co-author the letter to get a wide range of perspectives and inputs that would produce a useful analytical framework.
Larry, when you wrote the comment letter, you got a lot of comments in response, I imagine, to the letter. What about the comments surprised you most?
Well, I think we did get a lot of reaction, a lot of response, other comment letters, quoted ours. It's been written, been cited in the academic literature a lot and in the press. Congress has been interested in it. They called me down to testify about it. And I think, you know, it helped to shape the debate and the conversation. And that in itself surprised me. I thought we'd contribute something useful. And I think I sort of thought that we were helping to outline the challenges that an eventual plaintiff would make to the proposal in a court. But it really influenced the rest of the debate and the continuing debate, which is, you know, we're very humbled and honored at the capacity, the power that the letter has had. And I guess on a more amusing note, I was very surprised by one of my favorite magazines is The Economist magazine. And I was very surprised that they favorably quoted the letter in one of their feature cover stories.
So do you think that there is a version of an SEC reporting requirement that you would be comfortable with? Or do you think that reporting on climate risk is inappropriate government intervention pretty much under most circumstances?
Well, the SEC's existing rules already mandate disclosure of material climate risk, and that goes back to 2010. And I don't have any problem with that. That was investor-driven, and investors are interested in knowing about material risks of all sorts. And so companies have been making climate disclosure risks in accordance with that framework for many years. And it's a very tailored approach. Different companies have different exposures to, you know, different industries are more or less carbon intensive. And so the existing framework actually is, to me, satisfactory. And so I think one of the big problems with this rule is it goes to exactly the other extreme with a very, very high degree of regulatory specificity and standardization that exceeds the SEC's authority, but also doesn't probably deliver what investors really would need. And so I would recommend, rather than start trying to work with this document, what we recommended in the letter was starting over and go back to the existing guidance from 2010. And if the SEC believes that the disclosure produced under that regime is inadequate in some way, to try to surgically address that inadequacy and sort of work from the existing system rather than this revolutionary one.
Larry, in the document, you do speculate on whose interests are actually being served by this rule. So do you want to expound on that? Why do you think the SEC went this far?
Yes, it's striking. The SEC's proposal itself acknowledges the significant role of climate advocacy groups in motivating the proposal, and it cites them extensively. And these groups want to stop or mitigate climate change. Their mission is not investor protection, and they use the disclosures, which are, it will be extensive, transition plans, scenario analytics, internal carbon prices, climate-related targets, and so on. And they'll use those disclosures to criticize companies they think aren't doing enough to fight climate change. And then they lobby those companies to change their practices and urge institutional investors to back them up. So that's a primary beneficiary of this proposal are climate activists. And the SEC acknowledges that. The second principal beneficiary are large index fund managers who they face a tough competitive landscape, can scarcely compete on price anymore. Fees have been slashed to nearly nothing. And so profitability depends on spreading their fixed costs over a bigger pool of managed assets. So they need to attract more investors. And they have found it to be useful to emphasize that their fund prioritizes climate across the portfolio. And that strategy helps them to differentiate the fund. And so having this additional disclosure would reinforce the credibility of that effort. And again, the proposal is supported by quite a few of the large index fund managers. The SEC explicitly cites to them, relies upon them throughout the proposal with essentially no reference to the interests of individual investors, who is that's the primary intended beneficiary of the SEC.
But Larry, let me play devil's advocate. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with the SEC forcing companies to disclose how environmental groups can then put pressure on the companies?
Well, the primary reason is that it's not the SEC's job to change the operations of companies or to facilitate non-investor interests to pressure for changing operations. So it's not within the SEC's statutory authority to promote the interests of entities other than investors or to influence the operations of companies. So it's just not its job.
So that is very interesting, and it raises another important question. So first, I think I agree with you that the SEC is probably not the one who should be doing this. But I think there's this larger trend that we're seeing where people would like to achieve certain social objectives through institutions or regulatory agencies that weren't particularly designed for that purpose. And maybe this is motivated by the fact that apparently achieving it through regular channels is much harder than people thought. So if it's not the SEC, which regulatory agency should be trying to achieve these objectives?
No, the EPA got into some trouble a year or two ago when it went beyond the statutory grant of authority that the EPA had. And that lawsuit resulted, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed that the EPA had exceeded its statutory authority. And the Supreme Court made this ruling under a doctrine called the Major Questions Doctrine. And under this doctrine, the court says that when an agency conducts rulemaking on a topic that is of major social or economic significance, it has to be able to point to an express grant of congressional authority to do that. And I expect they would do the same in this case, where the SEC would have to be able to, because the significant or major questions of social economic policy, it would have to point to some explicit statutory grant of authority, and I just don't think it could.
The SEC's statutory authority focuses on investor protection. So the SEC has the authority to require the disclosure of financial information and other information that would be important to a reasonable investor in making an investment decision. But much of this regulation would compel disclosure far beyond what investors would consider important, and it really gets into questions of environmental regulation, climate policy. The SEC doesn't say that's what it's doing, but that is the clear purpose and likely effect of this.
So this kind of social policy of this order of magnitude, I think, would have to originate in the Congress. It would have to direct some agency, and it would be up to Congress which agency it should be, or maybe it would want to have a new agency.
But Larry, from my understanding, the legislature did in fact make an attempt to give the SEC more authority. Do you know what happened with that?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Jonathan. There have been three different bills in Congress in the last several years that would have explicitly granted the SEC the authority to compel disclosure about climate-related matters. And those bills got nowhere. They stalled every time. And that would be an additional reason to apply the major questions doctrine to say, look, not only can the SEC not find any explicit grant of statutory authority in its authorizing statutes, but quite the opposite. The legislature has in the recent past decided not to give you that power. And so the SEC will face an uphill battle on that one.
So what is your prediction? What will actually happen in court when people start filing lawsuits against this proposal? What is your prediction?
I predict that many lawsuits will be filed by a variety of different organizations, the state attorneys general, energy companies, the agents, the think tanks that put in the Society for Corporate Governance, trade associations, the advocates for business like the Chamber of Commerce, who have a lot of different lawsuits in a lot of different courts. And with many different arguments, the statutory authority, major questions, there are others about whether the SEC will have complied with the regulations governing rulemaking. There's even a First Amendment question out there. So many different parties filing many different theories in many different courts. And I think there's overwhelmingly high probability that one or more of those courts will enjoin the regulation on one or more of those grounds. So it'll probably never get into effect. My prediction is it'll probably never get into effect in its current form.
So Larry, thank you so much for being with us today. I think this was a very informative conversation. Hearing this perspective on these issues, I think, is important. And I think that we'll see what the future is going to bring. I think it will not be the last time that we're going to be having conversations like this.
I'd be delighted to talk some more.
Well, Larry, let me say from my side that obviously this FSO would likely come out after the final ruling of the SEC. Whatever that ruling is, I don't think anybody would doubt your role in helping to shape better legislation. I think the country should be very grateful to you for that. And thank you for providing the perspective on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the All Else Equal podcast. Please leave us a review at Apple Podcast. We'd love to hear from our listeners. And be sure to catch our next episode by subscribing or following our show wherever you listen to your podcast. For more information and episodes, visit allelseequalpodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn. The All Else Equal podcast is a production of Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and is produced by University FM.